Welcome everyone to What's Happening, a weekly podcast bringing you Bitcoin mining and mining related content. I'm your host, Cassie Clifton, and thanks for joining me today. In this episode, I'm joined by Nick Hansen and Eddie Wong, co-founders of the Seattle-based Luxor Technology, which they founded in 2018. Luxor's first product centered around offering a high-quality altcoin pool. They launched the Bitcoin pool in October of 2019, which has now become their primary focus. I actually met Nick and one of their fellow co-founders, Ethan, in Chengdu last October, right around when they had launched their Bitcoin mining pool. I was particularly excited about meeting Luxor, as they're a North American-based pool, and they intend to facilitate the adoption of SHA-DOM V2 among miners. We've seen a lot of mining pools come into existence over the last few years, so in my podcast, I like to dive into the ethos and logos that prompted the founding of each mining pool that I speak with. Everyone gets into the space for different reasons, but I think that those intentions are really important to emphasize. So we'll get into that. We'll also discuss Luxor's vision for the future, how they plan to get there, which actually begins with the profit switching pool that they anticipate to complete in this quarter. We'll also get into how the most profitable network is determined, considerations when building a profit switching pool, as Nick states his, quote, grandest accomplishment to date, additional features they built out for their pool, why Luxor places such a high importance on building a reliable spot market for hash rate, why miners based in the US should also consider a US-based pool, and we'll also get into payment mechanisms, so how miners contributing hash rate to a pool are paid out, which can differ a pretty surprising amount between from pool to pool. So there's definitely a lot that's covered in this podcast episode, and I highly recommend checking out their blog on Medium. They've got some really great stuff out there, but Luxor is also really eager to engage with anyone who might be listening and has questions for them, so please feel free to reach out to them. I've attached a link to their Discord channel in the show notes below, so you can check that out. You can DM on Twitter or however else you want to get in touch with them, but they'd be happy to answer any questions anyone might have. So with that, let's go ahead and dive into all this great content today. All right, Nick, Eddie, it's really great to have you guys on today. How's the new year treating you so far?
It's going great. I actually just took a plane back, a red-eye flight today from LA to Boston. So, you know, a little tired, but I got my coffee in, feeling good now.
So then, Eddie, you're based in Boston, I take it?
Yes, I'm based in Boston right now. I'm traveling all around. Our headquarters is in Seattle, so I'm going to be headed there.
Oh, I didn't realize that at all.
Pretty soon.
Very interesting.
Are you based out there?
No, we're actually in Nashville, Tennessee. So kind of an anomaly in the space, but there's a couple other companies here like Monero. A couple of the devs are here and they come and visit quite often. But aside from that, there's some other like smaller projects, but not necessarily like Bitcoin specific. So
Okay, cool. I thought for the longest time, I thought you guys were based in SF because you guys run the big Bitcoin 2020 conference, right?
Yes, we do. So we have to travel quite a ways for our team to get out there. So we only have one team member that's actually in SF, but yeah.
Okay.
Nick, what about you? Where are you based?
Yeah, so I'm in Seattle. Yeah, thanks for having us on. Happy to be here.
Thanks for joining me. I appreciate it. So before we dive in and get into some more technical details, I'd love to hear a little bit more about your backgrounds, what you were doing before you got in the space, and then like how exactly you did get into the Bitcoin space, mining space in particular too.
Yeah, super interesting story. Essentially, back then, a few years back, I was working product management at Scotiabank Digital Factory, and I just sort of got thrown in beside the blockchain team there and got super interested. Nick and I met, of all places, through GitHub. I was actually looking at, you know, we're both software engineers, and I saw his code on GitHub as an open source project. He was working on a decentralized storage application. I got really interested in hitting up, and we kind of connected on a lot of different levels. And we also found that in terms of our skill sets, we really complemented each other. So he was an engineer at Salesforce, and he's fantastic with back-end databases, working with bits, as I call it. Whereas like I love product and the front end, and it was just a natural fit. We decided to build a few applications together, and yeah, it's been a fun time since.
Super cool. So Salesforce, that's really cool. How long were you at Salesforce, Nick?
Almost or a little over 5 years, actually.
Oh, wow.
And yeah, as Eddie mentioned, when I started there, we were, you know, building various, you know, back-end features, and we, you know, we worked with front-end teams that would give us the, they would put the front ends on our work and do. And so it was really a natural fit for me and Eddie to work together because he's the one that builds, you know, the front ends and all the fancy apps that people love to interact with. I have experience building back-end systems, you know, distributed across the world and servicing millions of customers. So it was, yeah, it was really a great fit for us. And we're continuing that relationship going forward.
Yeah, so definitely complementary skill sets there. You said you were working on a decentralized storage project. Is that right? That's the GitHub code that he saw, the open source project?
Yeah, so there's a cryptocurrency called Siacoin.
And I was going to say, it makes sense why you guys are big fans of Siacoin.
Yeah, so they have a really cool premise, and we were trying, I was trying to build something called Sia3, which is, you know, basically Amazon's S3 backed by SiaCoin instead of Amazon. And Eddie saw that and thought that was a really cool idea. And we worked on that somewhat together for a little bit, ultimately decided that that project wasn't going to work out. And then we did figure out that there was a big opening in the market that was not being serviced, and that was for high quality altcoin pools, specifically SiaCoin in this case. We started building the SiaCoin pool in like August of 2017 and then mined the first block in January of 2018. Our first block, not the first block, but our first block of SiaCoin in January of 2018. And since then, have pretty much grown and expanded every month, month over month, adding new coins. And ultimately, we added Bitcoin in October of 2019. And that has been that's been our track up to this point.
Awesome. So what kind of, what led you to add Bitcoin as one of the coins in your mining pool?
We took a backwards approach to running our business, and I'll explain how. So SiaCoin is not the most natural coin to make a pool for, and the reason for that is pretty simple. If you're building a Bitcoin pool, or if you're building, you know, a Monero pool, there are tons of open source code bases you can start with, and it's basically you just have to configure some settings and it's all working, you know, and functioning. We took the opposite approach, and we did that with a good reason. The intent was to better understand, you know, what goes on, you know, in when we're talking about proof of work and consensus. And SiaCoin had a bare bones of what we call, you know, stratum, but none of it was really, you know, defined. And there was one piece of documentation out in the outskirts of GitHub. Aside from that, we had to kind of reverse engineer everything ourselves. So that included things like using Wireshark to sniff packets, you know, trying to, you know, configure our own miners and mine against our pool, you know, buy hash rate from NiceHash. So all these things really helped us, I think, solidify our skills as like mining pool engineers. And I think that's made a huge difference in how we operate in terms of how we've been able to scale up. And that, of course, like at the end of the day, Nick and I are both Bitcoin maximalists at heart. So
love that. You know,
Bitcoin was our calling, and you know, the opportunity came and we seized it.
And in general, it sounds a lot like you guys, you know, like you don't really want to put energy behind anything that you aren't passionate about, or like a project that you don't really believe is viable going forward. And it sounds like SiaCoin was a pretty natural, you know, step over for you guys. And then so naturally, like it sounds like in general, you'll only be adding coins that you believe in, at least fundamentally.
So that was actually our original charter, was we would only add coins that we fundamentally believed in. And if that changed, you know, we would end up delisting them. And we have delisted coins in the past for various reasons. Ultimately, I think right now we are very focused on Bitcoin. You know, we'll get into some of the, you know, some of the reasons why, I think, on the podcast. And right now, I don't think we have any plans to add any other coins. We get asked for, you know, coins all the time. You know, add Ethereum, sure. add Ethereum Classic. Can you add a Beam pool? And those are just some, that's just not something that's on our roadmap right now, because we're really, really focused on Bitcoin and becoming a competitor in the Bitcoin market.
It's really tough when you're growing too, to focus on scaling horizontally when you haven't like fully solidified your vertical scaling. So I think that's a pretty smart move by you guys.
Yeah, Eddie, is there anything that I missed there? Anything that you'd like to add?
No, you hit the mark there. We're focused on Bitcoin, and more specifically, we're focused on hash rate. We're trying to better understand and better define, you know, within the industry, how do you value hash rate? How do you sell it? And how do you utilize it?
Yeah, all of those are super important topics. And I think in general, in the mining space, there's not tons of transparency around a lot of these topics that you're hitting on. So before we dive into some of those topics that you mentioned, I'd be curious to know, like, what qualities are important in a pool that's kind of prompted you to build your own?
Yeah, that's a really good question, because one of the main reasons we started a mining pool was actually because there seemed to be an arbitrage between, you know, product and design skills and a lot of these mining pool operators. A lot of the most fantastic pools, you know, they didn't have the greatest graphical user interfaces. And while that definitely attracts, you know, a subset of like the cyberpunks, and you know, they'll use that pool. They like the grittiness of the website. There was this kind of new wave, you know, in 2017 during that bull run, of miners who were interested in the space but didn't necessarily understand every single component of mining, and didn't want to understand every single component. And that's where we try to fit ourselves in. We tried to make a pool that still delivered all the, you know, stats that you needed in order to make sure you're getting paid fairly, in order to make sure you're getting an efficient mining experience, but also trying to hide some of the stats that isn't as important under different buttons and toggles, so that when you do, you know, arrive at your mining statistic page, or, you know, that's what you would call it, it looks nice, right? And it feels like a good experience. And we're trying to basically take the next step in what defines, you know, enterprise mining, and how can we make that mining experience more professional as people who are trying to scale this up and come into the industry.
Yeah, improving UX and UI has been a pretty prominent movement across the entire space, I would say. So it's only natural that it would fall into the mining space as well.
Mm-hmm, definitely. Yeah, and specifically within the mining space, you'll find that a lot of the UX challenges are actually a lot easier than, and this is something that we've talked about internally, but a lot of the miners, they understand crypto, right? Whereas the B2C apps that you see, like the wallet apps, they're trying to target this entirely new generation of, or group of people that have no experience with crypto. And that's why it's been so hard for them to gain mainstream adoption.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I completely agree with you there. So I'm curious to know, I know that, you know, the Bitcoin mining pool that was launched in October, but what would you say are some of like the major accomplishments to date? What are the products and services that you're currently offering?
So my grandest achievement so far as part of Luxor is actually finding a Bitcoin block. You know, back when I started getting into crypto in, you know, like 2013, building Litecoin rigs made out of milk crates, it was kind of a dream to be able to build. It was kind of a dream to be able to build a something that could mine a Bitcoin block. That wasn't possible at the time, and I wasn't sure how I would even go about it. But now that we've actually got one, that's definitely the biggest achievement that we've gotten to date. Eddie, do you want to talk about some of the products that we've got and where we're headed?
Sure. Yeah. In terms of, you know, some of the cool features that we, you know, when we first started, all it was is you give a wallet address and you just mine with us. And then over the past few years, you know, while we've tried to scale in terms of coins, of course, features too. So we've got a pretty active Discord community. So we created, with the help of one of our community members, a Discord bot that helps you manage and, you know, track your miners and alert you if things, you know, go wrong. We also have a lot of awesome third-party integrations. In terms of mobile apps, a feature Nick recently launched. So he joined full-time about 3 to 4 months ago, I'd say now. And, you know, the first thing he worked on was called Catalyst. So the idea behind that is, you know, if you have any hash rate, right, and we're trying to price hash rate, a lot of people end up going towards Bitcoin because that's the, I guess, the native digital currency, if we're talking about the OG. So we have this ability feature now for most of our coins, where you can simply point any rig that's supported in our pool, point the hash rate at our pool, and Catalyst will convert that into Bitcoin.
That's really cool.
Through our own exchange backend. Yeah, so it's a great opportunity for a lot of the miners who don't want to deal with, you know, having an exchange account, managing, depositing and trading, get rid of a lot of the volatility risk. And it's more like dollar cost averaging, if you're talking about it in stock market investment terms.
I am curious to know, of all of these like products that you're working on, when the ideas were generated, did they come oftentimes from like you speaking to the miners themselves, or like where did a lot of these ideas originate?
Yeah, a lot of it is customer driven. The miners have a lot of feature requests, both on, you know, not just make, you know, launching pools for new coins, but also features and stats they'd like to see. And a lot of it also comes from our internal discussions on, you know, how we view the mining industry. And if you wanted to look at it from a broader lens, right, the way that we approach this is we're kind of the foreground of what the minting press essentially is, right? Like if you think about like minting money, the mining pools are very essentially responsible for minting Bitcoin blocks or Litecoin blocks, you know, whatever you call it. They are that minting press. Of course, it's the model's shifted a bit because we're now in this kind of decentralized paradigm. But at the end of the day, the mining pool is, you know, looking at the view of the blockchain, generating that work, creating the block template, and then organizing it all back together and submitting it onto the blockchain. So that's, if you look at it from that model, which is the model we view it as, it's really cool when you think about hash rate. It's much closer to, it's almost like a commodity in a sense. It's an interesting kind of digital value, digital energy, except you can transfer it from, you know, somewhere in China all the way across the world to a server in the US. And it's just about how you manage that process that that's super interesting. So a lot of ideas come from us turning the model upside down, looking at kind of the financial system today and thinking about, you know, forget Stratum, forget mining for a second. What is this actually trying to accomplish? Like, what is this hash rate? Let's try to define that first and value that first.
Yeah, I think that one of the things that people often miss when they think about proof of work is like how ingenious it truly is when you talk about like, you know, the printing press and whatnot and just printing money. That's a very different concept than what you're doing when you're, you know, finding the Bitcoin block and when you're creating Bitcoin. Because in our space, what we're doing is essentially using energy, another commodity, to create something of value. Whereas in the traditional finance system, all you're doing is printing value. So I think that's something that people miss, and I'm glad that you hit on that.
Yeah, and you know, to touch on that too, you know, we've been talking about proof of work a lot, and that's it's proof of work is so beautiful. Like just in terms of consensus algorithms, I think people, you know, when they come to the cryptocurrency industry, they hear these days about all these new fancy consensus algorithms, proof of stake, delegated proof of whatever, proof of authority. Proof of work is, the more you understand it and the more you dig deeper into it, you realize, you know, what Satoshi Nakamoto has done is incredibly efficient and beautiful.
No, absolutely. I mean, in the same way that you think about like other countries exporting energy in the form of like, you know, a physical product like aluminum or some other type of product, we can do the same thing here with Bitcoin. So
yeah, you got it.
Yeah, very cool to think about that. Kind of a side tangent, I was reading one of your blogs and you touched on something that you said that Luxor Tech was founded under the belief that the classical Nakamoto consensus is the only proven and tested mechanism for securing a decentralized platform, and that this was a debate that you guys revisited monthly. First of all, kudos to you guys for continuing to challenge your beliefs. I think that's super, super important in this space, especially with that kind of consistency and frequency. But I would love to get a feel for kind of like what that conversation looks like every month between you guys. If that's not too much to ask.
Yeah, Nick, I'll let you start with that one.
Yeah, it's pretty short, actually, because right now there's nothing that, I mean, it's just not possible. Like you can see the struggles that Ethereum's having with, you know, trying to make the switch to proof of stake. You can see it's just not feasible. I think that it will eventually be proven that proof of stake is not a valid consensus mechanism going forward. And so given that information, and how well proof of work has acted as a consensus mechanism, I don't think we're ever. We do look at other approaches, but I don't think we're ever going to, you know, really change our mind there. But we'll see. We'll see.
We'll see. Yeah, basically echoing what Nick said, but to add a little bit more color, we talked, you know, in depth about proof of stake and about all the issues with it, you know, and all the different approaches to it, but at the end of the day, the core issues, you know, and I won't repeat in detail, but things like the weak subjectivity issue, you know, you can't really decide on which is the real chain. I think those are very, very more important than Vitalik and, you know, some of these people in the proof of stake camp think is to be important when you're talking about something like store of value or something like money. Now, that being said, we have, you know, some coins that do have proof of stake elements. And in terms of proof of stake as a system to add certain elements of autonomy or add, you know, certain features to a blockchain network, it's interesting. I think it's an experiment, even more so than, you know, Bitcoin is an experiment. And we'll see how that goes. But even at that point in time, like proof of work is just always going to have the extra 10 years of just tested time against any other consensus algorithm. And because of that, I think unless there's something substantially better that comes out, and I don't think there will be, because it's been, you know, over 10 years. Yeah, I think proof of work is the one that people are going to stick with when we're talking about, you know, Bitcoin or talking about chains of value.
Right. No, I completely agree. When we're talking about protocol layer, I think proof of work is like hands down the winner there. But when we start talking about, you know, layer two and building on top of the protocol layer, I think that that's where like variations of, you know, different staking algorithms could potentially be useful and provide value of some sort. But only time will tell. Because I don't think that we're quite there yet to where we'll be able to really and truly market test what those layer two options are going to be able to provide us. So.
Right. And it's great that Bitcoin doesn't have to test that itself.
Right.
There's other coins to test that for Bitcoin. So I think that's a great thing.
Exactly. It's like scaling the value and what it can do vertically versus, you know, just as is and exists. So I would love to learn a little bit more about LuxorPool and what you guys are doing and kind of and how it's structured and how it's set up. I would be curious to know like what your payment mechanism is for the pool. And then like, what are some other common types of payment mechanisms for pools that you explored, but ultimately decided not to go with?
Yeah. So we are a PPS pool. PPS stands for pay per share. And there are many other mechanisms, dozens at least of payment mechanisms. The most common you'll find are PPLNS, which stands for pay per last end shares. And you know, you'll find prop, which is short for proportional. And then other variations of those mechanisms. PPS means that every time your miner sends us a proof of work, meaning you sends us some hash rate, we immediately credit your balance, whether we find blocks or not. Now, PPLNS, what that does is all of the shares are put into this pool of shares. And you know, if you submitted 30% of them, the next time we find a block, you get 30% of those rewards from that block. We found that PPS is the most transparent mechanism because you can actually do the math and say, this is how much I've submitted to the pool and this is how much I should have been paid. It is possible to do that math. With PPLNS, it's actually not quite possible to do that. Slush has made great strides by submitting what they call their hash rate proofs. So they can prove how many shares are in that pool. So when the rewards are all divvied up, there aren't any extra shares that you know would be the pool skimming or something like that. But we stick with PPS and we really believe that PPS is the best way to go. We have our own miners that we own and those miners mine PPS as well. Before we had our own Bitcoin pool, we had the mining PPS Bitcoin. So yeah, those are the different payment mechanisms and Luxor will always be PPS.
It sounds like too, going with PPS, that it's less work on behalf of the pool operator, right? Like if the overarching goal, at least in some large part, is to be transparent in what you're doing, then you would have to submit those proofs, right? Like Slush, which ultimately requires more work down the road. So a little bit of more free time for you guys, I suppose, in that sense.
So at face value, PPS is easier, right? Because all we have to do is increment your balance when you submit a share. We have to keep track, you know, that sort of thing. But what it does do is it makes it very risky for the pool. Because if there's, you know, there can be very bad, you know, variance, meaning we pay out, you know, we've had blocks where you pay 8 to 10 times the block reward to actually mine that block just due to variance. There's nothing, you know, malicious occurring there. And then there is, you know, malicious things that can happen as well, you know, such as block withholding, and share spoofing, things like that, which meaning the pool would be paying out for shares that will never result in a block. That's another thing that can occur when you mine PPS. Luxor has some ways of getting around those things. We've identified some ways to mitigate that, but there's no way you can mitigate variance. It's just the way of the world. It's, you know, variance is built into physics. You can't really mitigate that in any way. So the only way you can mitigate it is by taking a long view of the mining operation. You know, we need to make sure that we're looking at, you know, long periods of time. So
It may help to kind of use a model in another industry. We use this model frequently. We're essentially like a casino. When you're operating under the PPS model, I mean, it's great for users because when users are with us, they're constantly getting a stream of payouts and they don't have to be, the house in a sense and get the risk of, you know, what happens if the pool doesn't mine a block for very long. Another thing that's great for PPS pools is when miners are mining in PPS, they don't have to choose, you know, they don't have to worry about the size of the pool. Because when you're mining with, let's say, Kano, which is, a PPLNS pool, a very small one on Bitcoin, what happens is you're not going to find blocks for maybe weeks at a time. And, you know, it's completely based on luck at that point. And if you're talking about machines with a lifespan of maybe 8 to 12 months before they're replaced by the next cycle, you don't, as a miner, necessarily want to be taking those risks. Yes, you may get lucky, and that pool might find more blocks than expected, but you know, at the same time, you have the exact same chance of being unlucky and getting less rewards than expected, right? So that variance has a premium on it, and essentially us, we pay out and take the risk of that premium. So in terms of calculating PPS, it is easier for the pool. But in terms of risk management, and that's what Nick was getting to, it really sucks for us because, and generally only larger pools offer PPS. And you'll notice that because we take all the risks of, let's say, the pool going down, or let's say the pool having a bug and not finding blocks, because we're paying all our miners up front, right? So if we have a bug and we discover it 3 days later, that's on us. Our miners are still getting paid. They're still getting credited. And we got to take all of those risks. But because we're taking those risks, it's also a much better experience for the miners.
Very small detail before you guys carry on that I'm just kind of curious about. What happens if there's a miner that's mining on an invalid block template that's submitted?
Right. So it depends on where in the system, right? Let's say if it's stratum V2, it wouldn't pass the block negotiation, right? If they're choosing a bad template, if it's coming from us, hopefully we're always generating the right templates. But if we're, let's say we don't, and we pass a bad template, from our viewpoint, from our perspective of the blockchain, that is a valid template. So in that case, the miner would get credited for his or her shares because that was, we agreed to it, and then that is a valid job from us. So we have to bite that cost if that was to occur in the PPS model. In the PPLNS model, and just to clarify for the listeners out there, PPS means pay per share, and PPLNS means pay per last N shares, N being just, a period of time. So with PPLNS, let's say if you get a bad block template and, the mining pool submits and, gets rejected, nobody gets paid for that. So all that risk, is now on the miners. It's easier for a small pool to start out with PPLNS because they don't have any risks of operating the pool. There's no, they have no money in kind of the game. But for a larger pool or for pools that want to scale up, a PPS is really the only, I think, functional model for miners.
Very interesting. So that is a large risk to take on, and I know that you guys are thinking like long-term and down the road as how that'll pay off for you guys. But how are you hedging against that risk now?
For us, luckily for most of our pools, we are large enough that variance essentially isn't a huge issue. And that's what mining pools were created for, right? One miner trying to mine a block, you don't know, that it could be in the next minute, it could be in the next, 10 years or never. But with a mining pool, we are able to run calculations based on, our hash rate versus the entire network hash rate and get a sense of, what our luck should be over a period of time. Of course, we don't have huge market share in some of our pools. And in those pools, we'll see higher variances in revenue. So one month we might make a lot more money and another month we might even lose money. But what, if our math is correct and our code is correct and we are generally confident in our code, over, let's say, half a year, we expect to make that 3% or 2% fee that we charge.
Yeah, I really appreciate the series of blog posts that you've published on payment mechanisms. I haven't really found anything else out there that kind of explains it in the way that you have and just lays it out really clearly and simply. So I think that's really great to just have in the space. I don't think it's something that's often really talked about at all, at least something the average Bitcoiner doesn't really have a solid way to access that information other than reading through like really, really technical papers and whatnot. So yeah. I appreciate that exists.
No, thanks for that feedback. No, definitely something super important for us is education. We think that, the only way we're going to have people interested in hash rates, as that underlying product is for people to understand how it works, how people get paid for it. And yeah, the more education we can provide, the better. So I appreciate your feedback there.
Yeah, it's super, super valuable for all of the mining companies out there who are prioritizing education and willingly sharing and publishing on Medium or as, an op-ed or guest piece on other platforms and publications. So thanks for that, guys. I also wanted to hear about what else is in the pipeline for you guys at Luxor. What are some things that you're currently working on?
Yeah, our next big feature is going to be a series of profit switching pools, and those will be algorithm specific. The first one we're going to do is Equihash, which it just synergizes with our business really well right now. We have 4 Equihash-based pools, but we're going to take what we learned from that and apply it to SHA-256. So, Bitcoin, Bitcoin Cash, Bitcoin SV, Terra coin, all the SHA-256 coins. And we're pretty confident that that is something that will be very popular. I think that's going to be our most popular product once it's finished. The current revision is in a private beta now, using it as we speak. We are profit switching Equihash, and it's going really well. It just needs a little bit more time to harden before we can release it to the public.
Cool, that's super exciting. What would you anticipate that release to be? Like Q1, yeah, so, Q2?
Yeah, it'll definitely be Q1. Cool. Q1.
I would be curious to know, I think we can talk about like non-SHA-256 first and then SHA-256. What are some of the risks associated with profit switching?
Yeah, well, it doesn't really matter the algorithm. We can talk about any of them. Profit switching is rather agnostic, the concept anyway. There aren't a lot of risks. Some of the biggest risk is going to be efficiency. So say we're mining SHA-256 and we are sending out a bunch of different jobs from different chains. That can start lending to a higher stale rate and a higher invalid rate, which then takes away from the actual, you know, the profit bump, the uplift that we call it, that you get from profit switching. So that's something that we have to really be careful with. And that's what I'm working on now, is how to make sure that we're providing a very efficient pool while doing the profit switching. Because that's just something that you can't, say we offer a profit switching pool and we now have a 5% invalid and stale rate. Well, now you're actually losing 5% of your profitability, which means we have to either uplift you greater than 5%, or the profit switching isn't working and you would just be better off mining something else.
How exactly are you determining that, like when it's time to switch to a different network?
So a lot of it's proprietary, but we can talk about it a little bit. You know, at the super basic level, you can just determine what the PPS rate at any given point in time is based on the market price. So we can just say that the PPS rate for Bitcoin is X, and we know that the PPS rate for Bitcoin Cash is now 1.05X. So it's 5% more profitable to mine Bitcoin Cash. And you have to take a couple of other parameters into consideration, like exchange costs and switching costs. And then that's how we start calculating uplift. You know, the problem that we'll start to run into is what I call hash rate liquidity, meaning when you go sell some asset on an exchange, you can move the market some amount. With moving hash rate around, that the same thing occurs. You start to reduce the market condition that's caused the uplift, such as increasing the network difficulty. That's really the only one. Increasing the network difficulty, or if we had some significant sell pressure, you could also reduce the PPS rate that way. So those are those are some things that we have to consider when building a profit switching engine. But from a technical standpoint, they're all solvable. It's just an engineering problem at this point.
So I am curious to know, I feel like that there's a good amount of debate around this topic, at least profit switching from like BTC to BSV or BCH or whatever it might be, some sort of SHA-256, like ASIC hardware. What are your thoughts around that? Like, do you think that some of the concerns are valid in terms of like, leaving vulnerabilities in the security of the network? Would just love to hear what you guys' thoughts are, since you're working on this and building it out and, you know, have a really close up view of this.
Yeah. From like a very high level, I think a lot of the concerns are when you are talking about a pool utilizing profit switching without the miners knowing. Exactly. Without the transparency. And I think that is a big deal. So let's say a pool decides it wants to profit switch on, you know, the SHA-256 and mine Bitcoin Cash. Well, you've got a lot of Bitcoin miners that are, you know, mining to support the Bitcoin network and doing that in a kind of non-honest way to mine Bitcoin Cash. That's not okay. And I think it shouldn't be okay. I think, you know, if companies were found to do that, you know, people should be outraged about that. But what we're talking about here is, you know, kind of open transparency. Hey, this is, we are kind of pricing your algorithm, not a specific coin. If you want to mine a specific coin, we've got our pools available. But here's the deal: we think that hash rate, or algorithms, if you'll call it that, have an intrinsic value itself, and that value is going to be based on various market conditions, right? And for those miners, it does make sense for them to have that profit switching feature available. So we think at the end of the day, it's a feature that needs to be built. We think, will it affect security? I think that know if you do it the correct way. I think there's like a lot of, like, for example, the current state of the market, the biggest spot market or the only spot market is NiceHash. I think some of their approaches have kind of been made certain blockchains, not Bitcoin, but some of these smaller altcoin chains, right, exposed to certain security threats. I think those could be easily modeled away with a good company kind of leading the charge of developing a good spot market that also takes in kind of consideration of the fact that there could be attacks on these smaller chains. But this market needs to be created. A spot market needs to be created where we're able to price the underlying hash rate and get a sense of these mining farm business models. Because at the end of the day, if we want to get hash rate from China to the US, we're going to need to make it easier for people in the US and all around the world to be able to model their revenue and kind of profitability calculations over a range of time and not just depend on the volatility of, you know, a single currency.
Yeah, I definitely agree there. I think there's certainly demand for it. And I think like providing that optionality and putting the decision in the hands of those who are actually mining is the important part and not like, you know, more shadily doing it behind the scenes and no one really knows what's happening. I think those are good clarifications. Yeah, I would agree with that, which kind of brings me to my next question. So you mentioned moving hash rate from China to North America or outside of China more generally. Why is it that you believe it's so heavily concentrated in China? And like looking forward, how do you expect that to change over time?
Yeah. I can speak on this a little bit, but I'll let Nick cover kind of the base assumptions. But my base assumption is really simple. It's actually just based on like how the current mining ecosystem is modeled, and it's the time preference specifically. Right now, Bitcoin machines will last, you know, 1 or 2 years. And because of how volatile Bitcoin is, when you're buying these machines, a lot of it, you know, most of your profit is going to be generated the first 3 to 6 months of owning that machine. So in those kinds of models, what people tend to do is just, and you'll see this in China, they'll create these really cheap farms that are not meant to last, but they'll do the job for now. And they'll stack these machines, you know, sky high. And and you've seen some disasters happen, the fires break out. But at the end of the day, they're going to make a profit because just the costs of the fixed costs are so low. However, you know, that being said, that's not a system that's going to last forever, right? We know that Moore's Law is ending. We know that in terms of the SHA-256 ASICs, it's already trending down, you know, to near 7 nanometer, and then
which is on par with industry standards.
Correct, par with industry standards, exactly. And when we get to that point, when these machines start stabilizing, now it's a game about who can you know put that initial cost in. And then model out, let's say, a breakdown over the next 5 years, right? And when you kind of that kind of game, now the US or, you know, other parts of the world might be more advantageous because now we're thinking about government policy. We're thinking about long-term, you know, electricity rates and, you know, certain longer-term factors, I guess, that would affect the revenue model rather than something that would just last for, you know, a season or maybe a year.
Yeah, I agree. So, or a lot of the reason I think that hash rate is focused in China is mainly proximity. You know, we have all of the, why would you have, why would you ship these miners, you know, 10,000 miles across the ocean to set them up when they're being manufactured a couple hundred miles away? You can just set them up right there. I think that's the simplest reason, and one that I think is overlooked a lot, is that it's just really easy to do. You don't have to put them on a, you don't have to deal with customs. You don't have to do any sort of international shipping. Just put them on a truck and ship them where they go. That's one. And then, you know, obviously there were U.S. tariffs, which make it a lot harder for people in the U.S., you know, big investors in the U.S. to get miners here. The hobbyist is always going to get their miner, right? They'll pay whatever amount to get them. But when you're talking about people buying on the order of thousands of miners, that 25% plus tariff really starts to make that a tough investment. So I think, yeah, it's going to be something that the West is going to struggle with. If we could have a US-based, manufacturer, which there are rumors that that is occurring, we'll see if that happens or not. But if that happens, that's going to be really good for network distribution and, you know, making the West relevant in mining again. But for now, it's just going to be, I think this is going to be the status quo for for a while. I'm not sure if we're going to see much of a shift in the current hash rate distribution.
Yeah, I definitely agree. I think that it is necessary for there to be a manufacturing plant in North America somewhere for us to really see that landscape change, and that a like time/proximity factor are probably the greatest, just in terms of like time truly is money when you're waiting on shipments, and it takes a long time for them to get there versus you could probably just put them on a truck and drive them across the country. And then like two, the money factor where you're not paying any sort of like tariffs or duties on those imports. And again, the time factor there too. So I think that all of those are it's a little bit more simple that sometimes than people realize, but it's just, if you think about international, like from an international trade perspective, it makes a lot of sense as to why it's all over there and not necessarily that, you know, China has become this, you know, mining monopoly in a sense, but at the same time, like there isn't too much we can do without a manufacturing facility here. So.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, but like I said, I have heard that there maybe are some non-Chinese manufacturers in the works. So we'll see if any of those end up playing out.
Yeah, I'd be really curious to know where it will. I would imagine Texas, like somewhere along the border, but it's interesting. I haven't heard too many rumors. I've heard some whispers, but nothing concrete and nothing that points to any company in particular. So I suppose we'll see though. I would be curious to also know, kind of on the subject of decentralization, what would you say the current role of a mining pool is in decentralizing the network, and how might that change with new standards like Stratum V2 becoming more common?
You want to go, Eddie? This is a good question for you.
Sure. It's interesting, right? Like the current role the mining pool plays in some ways is very antagonistic to kind of, if the in the sense that if the pool is bigger, naturally they become more of like a danger to the network. And yeah, so this is what Stratum V2 is essentially trying to solve. And it's pretty exciting what the guys over at Slush Pool are working on. Essentially, like how we view the mining pool, it's that it's simply a software service, right? We're focused on providing like stability to these miners. It should be something that's part of their operation and they never have to think about or notice. We're just helping them process and convert their hash power into utility value, into the underlying coins or tokens. And with Stratum V2, it does help that in terms of letting these miners select the work, create their block template. But at the end of the day, I think the mining pool's end role is to really help define, when you're talking about these machines and whatnot, helping them operate them at the highest efficiency possible. So aside from just, with Stratum V2 picking out the work and such, essentially helping them monitor the payments they're getting. Like there's a lack of transparency when we're talking about mining pools these days. And it's just to the fact that when we talked about, you know, bad product design, or, you know, some pools are a little bit more shadier than others. And kind of our goal now in terms of 2020 is to figure out ways. And I think Slush Pool has done a good job with the way they calculate their shares, right? To show that they're not cheating when doing PPLNS. That's an example of steps that mining pools can take to continue to be more transparent to its users. And yeah, at the end of the day, we want to be kind of the tubes that run the infrastructure. People shouldn't have to notice us, care about us. And, you know, at the end of the day, we're just a service and part of this larger decentralized network.
Yeah, you guys are kind of like the steel that's holding up a building, but you don't necessarily see that. You're looking at the walls and the furniture and how it's designed.
Yeah, I think one thing that you kind of have to think about, or at least touch on, when you're talking about whether a mining pool is what the role is in decentralization. Mining pools are actually incentivized against decentralization. The pool itself wants all of the hash rate, right? So if the pool has all the hash rate, it's the one generating all of the fee from the miners, and they control a lot of things. So they're actually non-decentralized, they're pushing for non-decentralization. So what you need is a company, the people running the pool, to actually have a strong sense of decentralization or market fairness. And that's something that we've always been committed to. And I don't think you'll find anybody that will say we're against decentralization and are pushing for centralization in different ways. So I think that's really important to call out. And, you know, we continue to see these ebbs and flows in different, not just Bitcoin, but, you know, different coins as well, moving around the market distribution.
I completely agree with that. I think when you are talking about a pool, someone who's very much behind the scenes and, an area that there's not a lot of transparency on, even for the miners who are contributing to a pool, I think that picking a pool that has very strong moral and ethical foundings and really sees things more in black and white than they do in gray is really, really, really an important factor.
And I think another thing is that we're US-based, which also gives miners legal backing. Right. So if you're a U.S. miner and you feel like one of the Chinese, or you get screwed by a Chinese pool or some pool that's in another country, you have no legal recourse. Where we are held, I believe we hold ourselves to another standard, and you know the U.S. government would probably agree that we have to operate above board. And so that's another thing I think is really important and needs to be considered when deciding which pool to pick.
Especially if a lot of the facilities and organizations that are just popping up, new mining facilities in North America, in order to obtain capital for capital to flow into the mining space, I think that's a really important factor. Like when we're talking about investors wanting to hedge against the risks, especially from the traditional non-endemic space.
Yeah, and to touch on what Nick just said, some miners who have mined with Chinese pools, even Chinese miners themselves. Have kind of inquired about mining with us because we are US-based. And they are aware that, having all their hash rate in one place can be risky, just like holding all your coins in one exchange can be risky.
Yeah.
And they want to make sure that hash rate is spread out in case something happens and let's say the coins that they mine from a certain pool gets, blacklisted by a government or something.
Yeah. And even kind of just as a hedge against variance too. I think that's
right.
Probably a safe move.
Right.
So I would also be curious to know, I think that you'd mentioned that you guys had a pretty large goal of working with Pavel and Yan on bringing more proof of work coins into the space. Is that right?
Oh, no. It's close. We were thinking about, we wanted to add Stratum V2 to coins that are not Bitcoin.
Oh, okay. Gotcha.
Right. So Stratum V2 is not a Bitcoin specification,
right.
But the implementation is. So if we could actually implement it for other coins, that would be pretty awesome as well. So then, you could get the benefit of Stratum V2 for some of the altcoins that people like. We still have to do our Stratum V2 implementation. We don't even have that yet. We do plan to do that after the profit switching push here in Q1. We do plan to absolutely take on the Stratum V2 protocol as well. And we have a lot of plans, and we'll continue to expand on this. But we have plans to help miners get onto Stratum V2 and get their farms on V2. We may even be offering some free open source software to give out to get people up to speed and get people's miners using V2 sooner rather than later. And I know that Slush is doing that as well. But if there's more people, the merrier, I believe.
Yeah, definitely. Very, very benevolent of you guys. Very cool. Yeah, one step at a time, though. You guys have a lot of goals set for 2020 and vision for Luxor. So important to take that one step at a time. Cool.
Yeah. One thing you mentioned earlier, and I think we should, I'd like to, you said that there's not a lot of transparency around pools and how they work. If anybody has, anybody that listens to this has any questions, we usually will answer almost any of them. We'll answer pretty much all the questions. Just give us a shout if you have a question about how a pool works, how it runs, any part of it. We're willing to answer those questions.
Yeah, I appreciate you extending that to the audience, and I'm sure that they do as well. Always glad to have someone who's, willing to be hands-on and interactive and engaging with the community. So we are nearing an end. I do have one last question, and then I'll kind of open the floor to you guys. In general, what would you say is your perspective on the professionalization in mining? I know that we've come a long, long way from, where we were several years ago, but how do you expect the mining industry to mature over the next 3 to 5 years as well?
So I can start with this, and then Nick, maybe you can add more color. The way we see the mining space maturing is, a lot of the things we talked about earlier in terms of better standardization of machines, of software, of the infrastructure, the physical infrastructure, and figuring out how to build out these plans. A lot of these blueprints right now are still kind of being, I guess, like, there's different approaches, right? Different ideas, right? You have some people who believe in like capsules, some people who believe in buildings. So these approaches all get tested. There's going to be clear winners, and that's the first step. The second step, I think, is developing a very good spot market. And what that means is, you know, kind of the things we're working on in terms of profit switching, but trying to drive down the underlying value of an algorithm or a hash rate and getting a live price feed will be super important, because just like how Bitcoin has a very good price feed, we need to get a better understanding of what this hash rate value is and how we can distill it down into actual numbers that investors, but also these miners can use to have a more stable mining operation. What we find is, like, during bull runs, there's going to be a lot of mining farms that, you know, all think this is a great business idea. And then in times of volatility, you know, half or if not more of these farms just go kaput and go bankrupt and die. And, you know, that system will continue to go on unless there are these, you know, basically better data for the spot market. And then in terms of 3 to 5 years, we think the future is creating a derivatives market. So what that means is, you know, just like how corn farmers, you know, are able to deleverage the risk of just holding a bunch of corn, hash rate owners or hash rate farms should be able to deleverage some of that risk so that they can have a stable operation. And then on the buy side, you're going to have lots of hedge funds or, you know, more institutional players come in either trading on that data. And there's definitely a lot of market flow there that traders can trade on. And it's a pretty interesting space. So a lot of that is going to require education, but it's a pretty exciting kind of new asset class to work in.
Yeah, I think that's super important. When you think about commodities, there aren't commodities that exist that don't have that derivatives market, you know, like whether it be metals or oil and gas. So super, super important for the space.
Yeah, I think, and Eddie, I think you did say we want to drive down the price of hash rate. Well, what you meant to say was that we were trying to get down to the actual price of the underlying hash rate, whether, you know, we don't really want to drive it down.
Did I say that? Yeah, no. We don't want to
deducted later on, yeah.
Yeah. I think we want to
pinpoint the accurate price of hash rate, because that's hard to do right now. I mean, for other than pool owners who have that data, it's not very accessible to, let's say, traders or miners. And we want to make that more of a priority moving forward.
Yep, absolutely. So Eddie really covered it, you know, bringing professionalism to the space. I think the spot market is going to be a really big feature for Bitcoin. And once you have a reliable spot market, that opens up a lot of other areas for people to build contracts and futures and, you know, all sorts of, you know, these tools that financial traders use. You can open up that to mining. Like, so think about, like, that would revolutionize the mining industry. So we're, you know, we're thinking about these things. We're trying to figure out how to make them, bring them to the space. And we do have a plan about it, about how to do it. It's just going to take, us some time. So
what would be the first step in that plan?
Building a profit switching machine.
Okay. Well, there you go. So you're already well on your way there, huh?
Yes. We're very close to step one of many steps.
Yeah. What you guys are working on is really awesome, and love to have you guys based in North America. I think that's super exciting for the space at large. So we are nearing the end, but I did want to ask if there was anything else that you wanted to touch on before we wrap up.
Take it away, Eddie.
Nothing on my end, but like Nick said earlier, we're an open book. We're an open company. Join our Discord. Ping me. You know, you can tweet me at Twitter if you have any questions, Eddie plus Wang. And happy to answer and help if you're interested in building a pool, if you're interested in, you know, becoming a miner, and you have questions, we're more than happy to help you out and, you know, give you the resources to help you get started.
Awesome. Nick and Eddie, thank you guys so much. Did want to point everyone in the audience to where they can find you online, and as well as on social media.
Yeah. So we're online at Luxor.tech, and you'll get to our website. Social is Luxor Tech Team. So check us out on Twitter. And then we have a Discord. I'm sure maybe we can put that link into the description box. And smash that like button.
Awesome. And you guys can find me on Twitter at @BitcoinCast, and you can follow the show at What's Happening. And of course, be sure to subscribe to the show and stay up to date on all the latest mining podcasts. Thanks to all my listeners out there for tuning in to today's episode of What's Happening. The What's Happening podcast is a BTC Media produced podcast on the Let's Talk Bitcoin network. It was produced and edited by Christian Carollas. You can find more podcasts covering Bitcoin on the Let's Talk Bitcoin network and can follow them on Twitter at @TLBNetwork for all the latest episodes.